Hello, and welcome to The Brief, a video podcast that looks at global news events developing in the Middle East and brings you perspective and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. As always, we do appreciate that like or a follow, and you can find links to more of our episodes at thebriefpodcast.org. Israel's prime minister came calling at the White House and was warmly greeted by President Donald Trump in the Oval Office. There was, of course, no mention that he was under indictment for using starvation tactics against the Palestinians in Gaza. Now, the dire events taking place in the occupied territories are crucial to millions of Palestinians. They're also crucial to 24 Israelis still believed alive and held captive by Hamas in Gaza. Now, there was talk of those hostages and their plight at the White House, while the Israeli prime minister is under intense pressure at home after stalling the hostage releases to shore up his right-wing government. President Trump offered him a little bit of cover, saying he was working hard on the hostages. Well, President Trump also reminded us of his plan to turn Gaza into some kind of a resort, suggesting that Palestinians have the option to leave voluntarily, noted the prime minister, so as to deflect from the complete destruction of housing and the cutoff of all food and water supplies to Gaza that's gone on for more than a month. Mohammed Shahada is a Gazan. He's a political writer and analyst who has worked with the European Council on Foreign Relations. He knows firsthand what is happening in this critical moment in the Middle East, and he joins us now on The Brief. Mohammed Shahada, hello, and welcome to The Brief.
Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for having me.
We watched that White House meeting between Netanyahu and President Trump. What did you take away from that when you watched?
Absolutely lunatic. You have now Israel at a point where they say explicitly, if Hamas surrenders, dismantles itself, returns all the hostages, leaves Gaza, we would still occupy Gaza and kick everybody out. And at the same time, they are telling Gazans desperate to live, go and protest Hamas if you want to live, but we will kick you out anyways. So the final message is that Israel now has a clear mandate to finish off the Gaza question very explicitly, something that they did not make as flagrant as they had now very openly out in the open with the White House's blessings. So in February, last February, I met a Sudanese-American friend who's been to Gaza through the Department of Defense, and he said he met with Israeli generals, officers, and soldiers, the mid-ranks to the juniors. He said there was nothing behind their eyes. There's no soul. They were very eager to go into Gaza again and finish the Gaza question, burn the place to the ground. And I asked an Israeli former official that's close to Netanyahu, and I said exactly this: your soldiers, your officers are psychopaths. A lot of them are settlers from the hilltop youth, extremist lunatics, these sort of messianic religious supremacist Zionists. And he said, yes, but you need people like that to win this war. It doesn't get more explicit than that in terms of genocidal intent. Like genocide, you don't even have to kill people to commit genocide. You need to destroy a group in whole or in part, or render it impossible for them to exist as a group. If you send Gazans, divide them into a few thousands here, a few thousands there, and shuttle them all around the world where they can no longer exist as Palestinians, that is genocide by definition. It's not just ethnic cleansing. So they are bragging about a possible crime against humanity in the open, without any consequences whatsoever. What makes it even more maddening is that you don't have any condemnation from the so-called gatekeepers of the rule-based international order. You don't have any mainstream media being riled up against what is unfolding in front of their eyes as a genocide.
There have been few cases in history as clear as this one, and it has been ultimately very frustrating for everybody involved that any criticism of what Israel is doing is, you know, constantly getting smeared as being anti-Semites, having your visas revoked in the United States, students sent packing. There's been a very strong force in favor of actually not in favor of Israel. I don't want to say that, because it's not in favor of Israel. It's in favor of this small right-wing group that is hell-bent on exiling the Palestinian people and solving that problem.
Precisely. You struck a very important point, Jim, that this is not in favor of Israel. I was talking to Professor Avi Schleim yesterday. He said basically that the Israeli population has now gone unhinged after October 7th. They've lost their path, gone too far as a society, not just the political mainstream. But the few Israeli individuals that think rationally, that consider themselves our allies, they say this is extremely destructive to Israel itself. You have now Israel becoming a pariah state, an outcast, and you have all lists of consequences. Israel being accused of genocide, crimes against humanity, arrest warrants at the ICC, on occupation rendered illegal and an equivalent of an apartheid system. So they are on a path of self-destruction in that way. And the political mainstream is very keen to obfuscate that the way this ends is a very ugly way for the Israelis themselves. But at the same time, you have the American administration being more than happy to look at Israel and see them addicted to their occupation, addicted to committing crimes against humanity, and say, here, go and indulge your addiction even more. Like, if your closest ally or your closest friend is a drug addict, you don't give them more drugs, you don't give them money to buy drugs. That's the American approach. The Israeli approach is basically, if you bang your head against the wall and it doesn't fall, bang harder. It might. Keep banging harder and harder. If force doesn't work, use more force.
And it hasn't worked in the past. For years, decades, let's be honest, for decades, Palestinians and others have been told, you know, embrace democracy, embrace the rule of law. We are the guiding light for human rights. We come to this scene where tens of thousands of children, women, old men have been slaughtered mercilessly under the weight of U.S. bombs in Gaza. And suddenly, all of those words seem to mean nothing.
And even more ironic it is that it's disguised with this fake sympathy to the hostages in Gaza. So Trump was talking throughout this press conference with Netanyahu about the hostages. We need to get the hostages out. We need to get them out. But there is a deal already on the table to get them out. Hamas accepted it. Israel rejected. The ceasefire, when Netanyahu was forced to sign it in January, it showed two things. Netanyahu and Israel in its entirety, the political mainstream, the Israeli government, it will not want to end the war and would prioritize the genocide over its own hostages. At the same time, it showed Palestinians as basically the most self-restrained people I could imagine on the face of the earth. Can you imagine, like, a ceasefire goes into effect, Israel kills 150 people over the course of the actual ceasefire, and reneges on half of the promises that they signed on. As soon as they sign it, they say this is not an agreement, this is an outline, this is not a signed document, it's just the principles out in the air. Ever since there's been the Witkoff proposal that Hamas accepted, the Egyptians, Qataris on board, releasing five hostages, extending the ceasefire by 50 days, and negotiating phase two that would see Hamas step down from ruling Gaza and handing it over to either to the Palestinian Authority or to a Palestinian technocratic, politically independent administrative committee. So it doesn't get better than that for the Israelis. And yet you see Israel saying, no, we absolutely don't want that. We want to keep the war going on for the sake of freeing the hostages. But the past 17 months of genocide, during that time, Israel has killed more of its hostages than it managed to release.
You know, we're looking at this, and it is very clear to many people that the reason that this war was reignited and the hostage deal that you outlined there abandoned was because Benjamin Netanyahu needed cover from his corruption charges and the other problems he faces, his desire to upend the rule of law inside Israel to protect himself and his allies. He had to bring in Ben-Gavir, Smotrich, and others and make sure that they remained in his government, that he could stay in power. And that's what, at this point, that's what this is about. And they have true genocidal aims.
Precisely, they don't even hide it. Like, even before October 7th, about 7 months before, to be precise, the former very, very right-wing, and I need to emphasize this, he's very incredibly right-wing, former defense minister Moshe Ya'alon. He's someone who, at some point in the Knesset, there was an internal discussion, who amongst us here killed the most Palestinians, the most terrorists, the most Arabs? And it was him. And Moshe Ya'alon came out in March 2023 and warned. He said, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they subscribe to this underground rabbi called Dov Lior, who believes in the final war, the war of Gog and Magog. And they will provoke and provoke and provoke and provoke until they set the West Bank and Gaza on fire. And then you had Israeli members of Knesset, from Ben-Gvir's party, from the Likud party, Netanyahu's party, and Smotrich's party, explicitly saying in March, in the Knesset, we will return to Gaza. At that point, it seemed like a joke. It was inconceivable. And they stood on the podium of the Knesset, like someone called Limor Son Har Melech from Ben-Gvir's party. And she said, yes, I'm seeing us going back to Gaza and taking it over again. Bezalel Smotrich, on the night of forming the Israeli government in 2022, on the eve of being sworn in as a minister, he goes to the Gush Qatif Museum, the settlement that was previously in Gaza, with his family. And he signs in the guest book, he says, this was the greatest crime committed to the Israeli settlers. I promise we will return. So the intent was very clearly stated. What it needs is just matches to light up the fire. And the matches were perfectly and abundantly laid out in it to all to see. The daily pogroms in the West Bank, settlers going village to village, burning homes, burning shops, and lynching people. You had Ben-Gvir torturing Palestinian captives and prisoners, including national icons like Marwan Barghouti or others that Palestinians see as basically their hope of salvation, denying them bread, denying them shower time, squeezing them into tiny cells, and then provoking at the most essential symbol for Palestinian survival, Jerusalem. Jerusalem, the symbolism of Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Haram al-Sharif, is not just the religious connotation, but we see it as a compass. If Israel gets away with raiding it, with invading it, with Israeli ministers going storming the mosque, the holiest shrine for Palestinians in the land of Palestine, then it means our coast is being decimated without any attention to it. There's no backlash to that storming. It provokes Palestinian trauma that things are going to get worse and worse and worse. And you have that perfect combination of constant provocations until the fire catches up.
The fire caught up on October the 7th. And we now hear that there are some people in Gaza, not a mass movement, but very critical of Hamas for igniting this conflict and bringing hell down on their shoulders. And they look around. I mean, there is nothing left there. It is a hellscape. There's nothing left of Gaza.
What makes it even more painful is that foreign governments, European governments, the U.S. government knew this all the way a year ago. That was their assessment that Israel. So I met a top European leader in July last year. And he circled his tablet around the table with satellite imagery, neighborhood by neighborhood, that the EU has been collecting. And he said, look, Israel is systematically wiping out the place to ensure that as soon as the war stops, everybody leaves. Gaza becomes uninhabitable. What makes it even more painful is that they knew exactly what's happening. They didn't even speak up against it, let alone act or do anything differently. He himself said, don't ask us for anything political, only humanitarian. And then he sarcastically added that we are very kind people. We give Israel bombs in the morning, and we give you plasters and bandages in the afternoon to treat yourself from the bombs we gave Israel. With the protests that are happening in Gaza, there's a number of dimensions to it. First dimension is the grievances are very genuine. It's been there for years. Hamas's government is not particularly popular. It is autocratic in nature. And it stems the legitimacy for that autocratic rule from Israel's occupation, from the siege on Gaza. So if journalists or critics rise up and rally people against the government, Hamas would say, if you are trying to depose us from government, our survival is synonymous to the survival of the Palestinian struggle, of the Palestinian resistance. So rising against us means you are pushed by an Israeli agenda to kill the Palestinian struggle. And that sort of paranoia pushes them to crack down on opposition. So that autocratic style of rule, also like Gaza, the economy being decimated, Israel constantly trying to cause societal collapse, the autocratic nature of the rule is natural to keep it together. It's horrendous, it's condemnable, it's contemptible, but it is there as a result of the occupation. And people want, like Gazans, young Gazans specific, the vast majority of them are not Hamas or Fatah or any other political party. They are politically independent and they resent the whole menu. They resent Hamas, Fatah, Israel, the Arab world, the US, Europe, because like nobody's coming to their aid. They're completely forsaken. And a lot of them desperately cling to the hope that if Hamas leaves government, it would take away Israel's pretext for maintaining the siege and the genocide, which is why even inside Hamas's government itself, there were opponents of Hamas staying in government. The demonstrations broke out spontaneously. Hamas themselves, they agreed to the demands way before the protest started. So in December 2023, Hamas messaged their position to the Egyptians, to the Qataris, to the Palestinian Authority, Israel, the mediators, the U.S., and said, we want to step down from government. Let the Palestinian Authority take over with a technocratic government or an administrative committee. The most shameful part about these demonstrations is two things. Israel immediately weaponizing it with the full knowledge that weaponizing them would kill the protest potential. So when you have Israel Katz, the Israeli defense minister, coming out and telling Gazan, go to the street, rise up against Hamas, or we will keep killing you, taking away your land and home. You will not have any homes anymore, not property, not life. Protest Hamas or else. Do our bidding. Achieve what Israel failed to accomplish over 17 months of genocide. That renders anybody that shows up to the protest as a collaborator. People themselves would self-censor and not show up. Then Israel continuing to bomb the very areas that protesters are going out to and issue mass evacuation orders in them. Like, if Israel had the smallest interest in seeing these demonstrations succeed, they would say, we suspend our bombardment, the indiscriminate bombardment with 2,000-pound bombs, and let Gazans handle each other. But that's not what you have. So Israel is keen for these protests to remain limited. But they're at the same time keen to exploit them, the spectacle of the demonstrations, to shift the debate, to distract from the genocide. So friends at some mainstream media outlets are telling me their editors no longer want any coverage of the war itself. Everything they want is about the protests, even on days where protests are not showing up anymore, where it's not happening, because people are afraid to show up and get bombed on the way, or they don't see any impact of it. And then the last element, Israel has been saying for 17 months, there are no civilians in Gaza. There are no innocents in Gaza. Everybody there is Hamas. And as soon as people rise up against Hamas, Israel doubles down. It did not create any sympathy. I asked a lot of Israeli colleagues, like Daniel Levy and others, and I said, did you see any substantial Israeli sort of revision of their view of Gazans? They said, no, only reinforcements. So number one, Israelis would say, see, the airstrikes were right. We were right. These protests vindicate us. They show that the genocide is the way. If we intensify the bombardment more, if we starve them to death even more, they will show up in greater numbers. Or you have Israelis going like Netanyahu. He said, this vindicates me for collapsing the ceasefire. And you have other Israelis that are going completely bananas and saying, these protests are staged by Hamas to create some sympathy with the Trump administration to not kick everybody out of Gaza. And the people saying this are prominent Israeli journalists and people in government, or people saying, no, why are not more Gazans joining the protests? Why are they doing it now? They're not doing it to protest Hamas, but they're protesting that Hamas is losing. So they come up with all sorts of talking points to double down instead of changing any position.
And in effect, the hard right inside Israel wants a terror group, Hamas or whoever it is, because they need an excuse to carry on the conflict, to carry on what many have called outright genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. You have an Israeli minister like Bezalel Smotrich saying on camera, saying Hamas is an asset, the Palestinian Authority is a threat.
And Netanyahu has said that. Netanyahu said that in advance as they were funneling Qatari money to Hamas, saying we need Hamas because then we can say we don't have a partner for negotiations.
Yes, precisely. So even before then, like in 2014, Hamas agreed to step down from government and hand over Gaza to the Palestinian Authority. Netanyahu's reaction was to call off the negotiations under the Kerry Initiative, to call it off and tell Saeb Uraiqat, the Palestinian chief negotiator, we cannot talk to you anymore because now you're in agreement with Hamas, with terrorists. And Uraiqat remarked, ironically, he said, when we didn't have that agreement, Netanyahu was saying, we cannot talk to you because you don't have authority over Gaza. And now that we did, he's saying, we cannot talk to you because you made an agreement with Hamas. Even before then, like in the 80s, you had an Israeli strategic analyst, prominent one from the Israeli right. He was called Avner Yaniv, that wrote a book, Dilemmas of Security, in which he argues that Israel is facing a threat from Palestinians, not violence, but a peace offensive. That's the term he coined. And Palestinians are waging a peace offensive by becoming more moderate and rising to international respectability. that embarrasses Israel, that creates some international pressure on Israel to negotiate, to actually relinquish the occupation. So he recommends basically decimating the Palestinian Authority in Lebanon with the utmost intensity of firepower to weaken the moderates and strengthen the hardliners in the PLO again. Back then, there was the King Fahd Initiative, a copy of the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, full normalization between every single Arab country with Israel in return for giving Palestinians 22% of historic Palestine. The Lebanon War, in part, was to kill this.
People look at what's happened in Gaza today. They see the shocking images of the rubble that now just stretches from one end of that strip to the other. And they have to ask, what's it like to be a Gazan? You're being driven pillar to post. You have no solution. You're damned if you do. You're damned if you don't. What's the outlook in there for people?
I asked that specific question to a top EU leader, European leader. And I said, okay, with all your years of wisdom, what should we do as Palestinians? If you were a Palestinian, what would you do? And I asked him the same question three times, because first two times he avoided it. The third time, after he'd given it some serious thought, he basically collapsed in his chair with, like, the body language was completely revealing, complete paralysis. He collapsed, tried to gasp for air, and then he started to mutter to himself, saying, they tried this, they tried that. And then he says, there's nothing Palestinians can do. There's absolutely nothing. And he repeats it mindlessly. He says, there's nothing they can do. There's nothing they can do. And my answer to him was, this proves Hamas right, because the appeal of Hamas is not the appeal of their ideology, but the failure, the foiling, the betrayal, the crushing, the humiliation, and the demonization of every single alternative that Palestinians try or have tried in the past. Nonviolence, diplomacy, legal action, advocacy, whatever it is. Israel calls all of these things terrorism. Even diplomacy, Israel calls it diplomatic terrorism. Protest, PR terrorism, human rights organizations, terrorists in suits. Even if you go on a hunger strike in an Israeli concentration camp like State Ayman, that Israelis themselves refer to as a concentration camp or a torture camp, Israel calls this terrorism in prison. So your pure existence is terrorism in Israel's eyes. And what does that leave you with? Even there are Hamas leaders that acknowledged on the record. One of them was Saleh Haruri, Ismail Haniyeh's deputy, the deputy top leader of Hamas. He acknowledged in 2021 that armed resistance itself failed to challenge the status quo, to create a breakthrough. And he said it displayed, quote, heroic examples, but it failed to create a breakthrough, to remove the blockade. So he was acknowledging it. But when everything else fails and people are stuck in this permanent state of non-life, literally, the most devastating aspect of it, whenever I get the news of another friend or family member or loved one in Gaza getting killed, is the realization that they died, they got killed, their life was stolen away before they ever got a chance to experience it, before they ever got a chance to experience what it means to live, to fall in love, to move out of your parents' home, to find a job, to put food on the table, to travel, to see the world, to have purpose. They don't have any of that.
We look at it from the outside and just see this hopelessness. It's, you know, I'm the European diplomat collapsing in my chair, admitting that there is no alternative for the Palestinians. How much credence should we put in the social media posts that indicate some Palestinians in Gaza are saying, right, take me away. Get me out of this hell. I want my family to survive.
Well, up until the ceasefire was signed and during the ceasefire, I had friends and family in Gaza who were still clinging on staying there. I had friends and family outside Gaza who were desperate to go back. A lot of colleagues who would say, we feel a moral responsibility, a survivor's guilt, that we need to go back and contribute one way or another. When the war was resumed, I saw complete collapse. I have a friend, not to compare, but to substantiate the argument with an anecdote. I have a friend whose parents survived the Holocaust. And he said on the day his mother was liberated, she was asked by a journalist later on, she said, that must have been the best day in your life. And his mother looked with complete outrage and contempt. She said, best day? How dare you? It was the worst day in my life ever. Because that's the day where you actually get the mental capacity to process everything that's happened to you, that you don't have a family anymore or home anymore. Like, you are occupied with pure survival throughout the 17 months of genocide. The adrenaline, the basically, your mind goes into a specific mode to help you to survive, to get through the day. But once the noise stops in the background, you get more mental energy to understand what it has meant for those 17 months. Like, I started having nightmares after traveling out of Gaza, not before. I started feeling the PTSD after getting out of Gaza, not before. But to get that moment of pause where you internalize it, understand it, and then resuming the indiscriminate bombing with greater intensity and the starvation, I see full collapse. A lot of people are now writing it on Facebook and social media. Get me out. Get me out. It's basic survival mechanism. I had a friend in Gaza who until October 7th constantly scolded me. He said it was the worst decision in your life that you traveled. You need to come back. He was a computer engineer. So one of the fringe minority that managed to make a decent living by working online from Gaza despite the blockade. And he always gave me hope. And then after October 7th happens, Israeli soldiers, they walked into his apartment, burned it to the ground. Nothing is left. They bombed his parents' home. They razed his siblings' homes. And then he writes me, "I'm sorry that I told you come back. That was a mistake. It's good that you didn't trust me. Remember me." And I try to keep in touch later on. And now he's begging to get out. He said his son, who's about 3 or 4 years old, is having constant seizures. And he doesn't know how to treat it anymore. I have friends with, like one of my close friends in Gaza, he said basically his mother was wounded at some point in her arm and she was never operated on and the bones healed in the wrong way. And she's never got an operation and she cannot get any because hospitals are rationing their capacity and prioritizing kids over adults and elderly. I have friends like a close friend whose mother died because the doctor said, "She's old, let's prioritize the people that just got in from an Israeli airstrike. We do not have the time or resources to give her treatment." So they let her just die in front of her daughter. And I have a friend who's been half paralyzed in half of his body without any treatment. With all of those, with the added starvation and the indiscriminate bombardment, it's the most natural thing that they want out. But that doesn't mean out permanently. Even people that are out, as I said, are craving going back again. Gaza is our home. I've been around the world to many countries. Gaza in its uniqueness is completely appealing to someone who grew up there that I would choose it over anything else.
Ironically, perhaps the strongest allies Palestinians have are those Israeli Jews or Jews living in the diaspora that have chosen to lift their voices up to stand with Palestinians. Now, they're being criticized bitterly as well by the hard right forces that are at play inside Israeli politics at this point in time. But they're vital to this, to the very survival of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They are very crucial and necessary allies. And they're working not just for Palestinians' interests, but also for Israel's own survival. Israel cannot survive if it rules over a population that forms the actual majority within its borders who is not Jewish and who is not going to accept living like slaves or second-class citizens or even non-citizens. And with those individuals, like, there's always the complaint about the rising tide of anti-Semitism. And one of the things that I've seen intimately to be the most efficient, effective treatment and remedy for anti-Semitic bias is those heroic Jewish activists that are protesting for the end of the genocide in Gaza. I've seen a lot of Arabs who previously did not possess sufficient knowledge to surgically differentiate between a Jewish person, a Zionist person, and an Israeli, explicitly stating, "Look, these protests, they are led by Jews at Columbia University, at the student encampments, the Jewish Voice for Peace, if not now, all those phenomenal groups," and saying, "Look, there is a difference." And others pointing to people like Daniel Levy and saying, "Look, Daniel Levy, an Israeli British who's been extraordinarily vocal on the Gaza topic, on the Palestinian topic, and has been consistently moral throughout the last 17 months. It creates a lot of difference in terms of combating anti-Semitism." So I'm surprised that organizations like the ADL are not jumping at this opportunity and investing in those individuals, that instead they consider them as collaborators, or they try to tarnish them in every way possible.
And worse than that, they're trying to pass laws in the United States that will make criticism of Israel illegal. They're trying to subvert the First Amendment in the U.S. or the equivalent of that elsewhere, you know, in the name of preventing anti-Semitism, I think it ends up promoting anti-Semitism.
A friend of mine would always say, when Netanyahu goes to the American Congress and you have every single Congress member, Democratic and Republican, clapping like seals, mindlessly, like androids, robots. This is insane. If he says, like, if I was the Israeli prime minister, I would tell them, don't clap to me unanimously, every single one of you, 100 times within 10 minutes, because that would be an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory of saying, look, Israel is controlling the U.S. Senate. Like, they don't clap as hard for Trump or for Biden or for any U.S. politician as much as they clap for Netanyahu. But now when you have people like Bitar, an extremist organization, explicitly saying, we possess the power to deport you. Who are you? Who are you to hand lists to the White House to say deport this individual or cancel the citizenship of that individual? And they're now even going against Jews in the U.S. to say, if you criticize Israel, we'll make sure Israel will ban you as well. It doesn't get more blatant than this in terms of fostering a very dangerous bias or conspiracy theory that we have invested so much power and resources and time into trying to educate people about, that influence doesn't mean control. But when you have people explicitly saying, no, we have the control over the White House to deport you, I'm surprised that the ADL is not condemning this.
On the other hand, I look at the Palestinians themselves, and it's undeniable. I mean, you've got the Palestinian Authority with its aging leadership. Hasn't been an election in decades now. And I know there are efforts underway, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that, for the Palestinians to come together somehow and reform a national movement, reform a single voice that can stand up and express their political point of view and their aspirations.
That's a very crucial point. So I always try to tell it to fellow Palestinians that we rely too heavily on two elements in our narrative that are counterproductive, shock and anger, by showcasing our scars, our pain and our wounds and our dead and killed loved ones. But shock, the human mind has hedonic adaptation, a function that guarantees you will no longer be shocked by the same images when you're exposed to them a thousand times. And anger is unsustainable. It burns very quickly. You need to inspire. There were days where Yasser Arafat would go to India, for example, and you have hundreds of thousands of people taking to the street to see him. When he walked into Gaza, the entirety of Gaza went out to see him, just to get a glimpse of him, because of the ability of the Palestinian struggle to inspire. And I try to always say that when the Israeli genocide comes to an end sooner or later, when the bombs stop dropping, the world's attention will no longer be on what Israel is doing. It will be on you. What do you want? And how do you keep that attention? How do you inspire them? And there are some impediments to the ability to inspire. One of them, as you rightly pointed out, the absence of a unified leadership or the absence of an actually representative leadership. And that's a topic that, as Palestinians, we've been trying to work on for decades. We got very close in 2021. Elections were called. About 36 political parties signed up. Some of them were completely unaffiliated with both Hamas or Fatah, like a list that was called We Want to Live, that included a lot of youth in it. It was brilliant. It was inspiring. But right before, you had the Israeli head of the Shin Bet going to Abu Mazen, our president, and telling him twice, face to face, call off the elections, cancel the elections. And then Israel going and arresting candidates for parliament. And then Israel preventing the elections in East Jerusalem. The final result of it is that the elections collapsed. You cannot hold it anymore if you exclude about 300,000 Palestinians and give Israel explicit legitimacy over occupied East Jerusalem. There were other initiatives to try to move the sort of stagnant waters. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti tried something recently, many other individuals as well, to try to revive a Palestinian collective. But if you don't have, elections are the best way, the most efficient way to revive electoral accountability for the leaders that have been in office for about two decades to actually sit with themselves and ask, what do people think of me? Because that incentive was absent for the last two decades. They didn't bother to think, what does the Palestinian public think of me? Because there are no elections. I can stay in office. But if you don't have elections, there's the alternative one. Marwan Barghouti, getting him out of prison. And I always tell that to American and European interlocutors, that it is in their best interest to see someone of this huge magnitude coming out to unify Palestinians around him. See, it's not because of some extraordinary intellect or courage or prowess or sort of like uniqueness. I don't think Nelson Mandela was extraordinarily intelligent. He was very iconic, very brave, a hero. The same Lincoln. Lincoln had a lot of prejudices against African Americans. Gandhi had a lot of prejudices against Africans, black people. Mandela advocated for violence. Heroes are not perfect, but once you have an individual constructed as a national hero, he is capable to shift the thinking of an entire group, to convince them to move into one path or the other, to accept a peace agreement that would be unattainable under another leadership. So, for example, if I say killing Israeli civilians is terrorism, it's wrong and it should be condemned, there would be a lot of Palestinians saying, but what about Israel killing 1,000 times as much of ours? So the message from me would not resonate. And what about settlers that are armed to the teeth that go village to village launching pogroms daily? But if Marwan Barghouti says it, and he said it on a video, and I posted it as it is, it gets enormous respect and momentum. If Marwan, like, we know already his convictions, he's pro two-state solution, pro nonviolence, pro peace. So he fits the full list. And if he comes out and says, Palestinians, as Palestinians, we have a long tradition for hundreds of years of being peaceful. We are the land of Jesus Christ. He would mobilize, galvanize the entire population behind him with that message. But you have Israel explicitly saying he's never coming out, because they're not actually interested in ending the conflict. They're, like the saying that Israel has, every that Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, it's one of those moments of every accusation as a confession. Because there's been a huge number of Palestinian peace offerings, proposals, ideas that Israel rejects out of hand. The final is the one that came from the Egyptian Arab plan that was endorsed immediately by Hamas. It addresses a lot of Israel's security concerns. It talks about disarmament. It removes Hamas from ruling Gaza. It talks about reviving a trust-building
process. It would seem to be everything that has been demanded of them.
Exactly. And Israel rejected it immediately out of hand, the White House as well.
They don't want necessarily, but they don't want a solution. They would rather have dominance and occupation than a genuine peace.
Exactly, because there's no cost, there's no dilemma that Israelis face. They can maintain the occupation with no consequences. I was recently in Berlin, and at
Are consequences, though, and I think many Israelis realize that. There are consequences, social consequences, mental health consequences. They have to, as one Haaretz editorial said, they're going to have to wake up and look at themselves in the mirror and realize what they've done. That day is going to come. They have been starving children as a way of exerting pressure and forcing the Palestinians to give up. I want to ask, are Palestinians going to give up? How are they possibly clinging to any hope today?
You strike a very important point. So basically, a personal story that I lived through about a decade and a half ago. We were stuck in Egypt when Hamas took over power in Gaza, and there were no functioning border crossings because Israel closed the Erez crossing and forced Egypt to close the Rafah crossing. So we were like there for medical treatment for my brother. And Israel allowed us exceptionally with a group of Palestinians that were getting medical treatment in Egypt to cross through a border crossing between Egypt and Israel with no Palestinian element to it. It's called Al Oja. It's a commercial crossing. So, and then to Erez from there. At Al Oja crossing, the Israeli soldiers there, teenagers, literally teenagers, 18 years old, 19 years old, I can tell they've never seen a Palestinian in their life, and they've never spent a day in the occupied territory. They were a lot more polite and nice compared to the ones that are serving in the territory. They're more calm, composed, and brought us food, tried to help with wheelchairs, whereas the people at Erez or Rafah, the Israeli soldiers, would be the most supremacist, the most racist I've ever seen in my life. I was a child at the time where they would point a machine gun at me, I think I was like maybe 6 or 7, and say, "Irja liwara," move back, and drop your, take off your belt. do this, do that, and order me around as a child. So what it told me is that Israel's occupation corrupts the souls of the oppressors as much as it ruins the lives of the oppressed. But now you have occupation on steroids, and you have genocide. Like that, it's a very frightening idea for me. Imagine living in a society where you have about 400,000 people that took active part in a genocide. That's Israeli reservists. That your child's teacher at school, your doctor, your nurse, your next door neighbor, your family member might have committed war crimes, might have raped an innocent woman, might have tortured someone to death, might have shot a child in the head, might have literally run over a civilian with a tank and turned them into mush. What kind of society does that leave you with?
It's one of many difficult questions the Israelis will have to ask themselves. But it's also a difficult question, you know, for the entire international community that seems to have thrown up its arms. And as Donald Trump made very clear, he just, whatever it is, he wants it to end quickly. I don't think it is going to end quickly.
The thing with Trump is that there are two branches in his administration. There is the messianic lunatics like Mike Huckabee, Mike Waltz, Mike Rubio, that are taking Israel's side no matter what. Israel can do no wrong. And then you had two people, Steve Witkoff and Adam Bowler, who are trying to actually get a deal. That's why Adam Bowler was fired, because he was talking with Hamas, not just about the American hostages, the one living hostage, Aidan Alexander, and the four bodies, but he went further to talk about truce, cessation of hostilities completely in the West Bank and in Gaza, dismantling tunnels, stepping down from government, laying down arms, all the topics that Israel does not want to go into to maintain the facade, the fig leaf that allows them to carry on the genocide. And with Witkoff, even like Arab mediators would tell me the guy is genuine about getting a deal done. And he said recently something that angered the Israelis a lot. He said, Hamas is not suicidal. They're not ideologically intractable. Israelis were like, how dare you say that we can do a deal with them? But you've been negotiating with them to get a deal. So why are you negotiating if they are ideologically intractable? But the thing is that it's a competition between those two strands. And Trump is influenced by the last person in the room. That's what American diplomats are telling us behind closed doors. So, for example, in 2017, when he visited Beit Lahim and met Mahmoud Abbas, our president, he basically sat down with him with the impression that Abbas was a terrorist, because that's what Netanyahu told him. And Abbas came with a clear position. Less than 22% of historic Palestine, a demilitarized state that would have NATO and U.S. troops guaranteeing Israel's security on the ground. And he offered all the security guarantees possible. He told him about the intelligence sharing between Israeli and Palestinian security forces, the security coordination mechanism by which Palestinian security forces protect Israelis from any Palestinian threat, but not the other way around. They're not allowed to touch an Israeli settler, even if he opens a machine gun in the middle of Ramallah. But they would go and arrest and beat or imprison or even kill a Palestinian that would try to attack Israel. So he explained all these things. And Trump was immediately impressed. And it got to a point where Trump said, I think we have a deal. And when you get to the part of the land swaps in the negotiations, reach out to me because I work in real estate. I know how to pick up a good piece of land. I'm going to give you advice. Trump walks out the room. And then Jared Kushner goes back, takes Saeb Erekat, the chief negotiator, on the side. And he says, forget everything that POTUS just told you. None of it counts. You deal with me now.
Do you have much hope left? What is your goal now?
Well, basically, I try to sometimes even lie to myself that there is hope. There's the hope of people, like the cliche of saying things would get darkest before the dawn. I'm not sure if it always does. There are other cases where it didn't at the end. Native Americans, indigenous populations in Canada, Australia, New Zealand. But what gives me hope is that one of the things is the Israeli realization that they cannot be safe unless Palestinians are also safe. They cannot have a normal life, that sort of shattering the illusion of normalcy, that they cannot have a normal life without Palestinians having a normal life. The problem is that Israelis now are at a point, they realize that managing the conflict, buying time, is stupid. It's counterproductive. It's going to blow up in your face. But they are now at a point where they are at the wrong conclusion of thinking that there is a military option to get rid of Palestinians, either to kill them or to move them out of the territory. Once they realize that this is not feasible, this is not possible, it might create some room to say, if we cannot get rid of you and we cannot live normally and peacefully while you are suffering, then let's talk something out. Like the only time that Israel tried something that would sort of akin to a minimal attempt at peace with Rabin, it was not because Rabin was good-hearted. 5 years before, when the PLO declared the Algeria declaration, accepting basically the two-state solution, he came out as defense minister and he said, we need to crush this. This is extremely dangerous. And he instituted the breaking the bones policy, where Israeli soldiers would literally shatter the bones of Palestinian peaceful protesters. What changed his heart was the pressure of the First Intifada, the PR pressure on Israel, its failure of the propaganda machinery, the depletion of the IDF, that soldiers, instead of training, they were running after kids in refugee camps. And the final element, international pressure. Israel was under basically an international sanctions regime, implicit one, where international corporations would not dare open up branches or sell their products in Israel out of fear of an Arab boycott by the entire Arab world. So Israel's startup nation, it started after Oslo, not before. All those international companies in Tel Aviv, now Microsoft, Intel, they started after Oslo. The pressure that preceded is what moved them there. Like, even internally for Palestinians, it was not the appeal, the moral appeal of the two-state solution that got us to accept it. It is being explicitly told, this is the maximum the international system is willing to offer you. And if you go against it, if you say, no, I want the entire land, you will be crushed under the full weight of the international system, the international community. So you have to settle for this. You don't have the same messaging for the Israelis. It's ironic, like when I meet with European and American diplomats, their approach is they are afraid of pressuring Israel because it might strengthen the hardliners and weaken the moderates. That's their talking point. But at the same time, they say we need to pressure Palestinians to weaken the hardliners and strengthen the moderate. I'm not sure how does that logic follow. But what another element that gives me hope is basically the practical realization from intimate experience. I've lived through 3 Israeli wars, 10 military operations, 2 ground invasions. The realization that if you stop trying, things will only get worse. It will not stay the same. It'll get dramatically worse. Is this insatiable lust on the Israeli side to take over everything and leave you with nothing. And sort of the sort of Confucius quote that he persevered on a path with the certain knowledge that it was hopeless, not because he expected to win, but because it was the right thing to do. To be able to live with myself, to know that I do not carry the enormous burden of not doing something, that at least I'm trying. I'm failing constantly, but I'm trying. I met European and American former officials that are now living with shame and guilt because they made the wrong choices on this topic. So I was recently in Berlin. A German official has been basically sick for the last 6 months at home, senior diplomat, very decent guy. And I called him and asked, what's happening? He said, I suffered a moral burnout. I couldn't put up with Annalena Baerbock and Scholz and the EU and this sort of sham repetition of the same talking points that don't mean anything. And there's a similar American official that after leaving office, he became manic depressive, bipolar, that when friends and colleagues explained to him the situation in the occupied territory, he starts crying and tearing because he feels personal responsibility for it. So I always try to tell those people, like, don't do this to yourself. You will not regret it now in the immediate term when you are in power, when you are in a mainstream media, in CNN, New York Times, surrounded by this sort of prestige. But you will later when your own community shames you for it.
Mohammed Shahada, a man with a message. Keep the hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us on The Brief.
Thanks for having me. I always appreciated your moral consistency and an important work on the topic, Jim.
And thank you for joining us. Please explore many of our other episodes of The Brief podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Give us a like or subscribe. For a complete listing, you can find more information at thebriefpodcast.org. For now, I'm Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.